This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think things are changing, but again, like in all other changing perceptions of the world, from Galileo's The Sun Being the Center of the Universe, things take time to change. But fortunately, I'm pleased to see that the majority of the public actually gets it.
Our planet's rising oceans are no longer the purview of pessimistic doomsayers. They are the new reality. This week's guests on Sea Change Radio are both trying to help us adapt to the phenomenon of crumbling coastlines and swollen seas. First, I speak with author and oceanographer John Englander, whose new book, High Tide on Main Street, provides a roadmap for readjusting our fiscal, social, and political expectations in a world with significant sea level change. Then we hear from David Hedman, the inventor of a mold remediation technology that's sure to find an escalating demand in the impending diluvial age. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by John Englander. He's an oceanographer and an author. His latest book is High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level and the Coming Coastal Crisis. John, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Why don't you first give us an overview of the basic premise of High Tide on Main Street?
Sure. The book wades the normal projections and the discussions about whether we're going to have 8 inches of sea level rise or 12 inches by when, which is normally the focus. What it does is it goes back and puts it in geologic context, say, what's happened to sea level? If we can understand the past, we can probably see the future much more clearly. And when I look at that from my geologic perspective, we find that sea level does go up and down dramatically, about 300 or 400 feet with each ice age, which surprises people. But when we think of 2 miles of ice on North America and Europe melting every about 100,000 years for the last several million years, that's enough to change the ocean by that height. So that's the first grounding perspective. And it was just 20,000 years ago that the ocean was down 390 feet below the present. When we realize that and see that following the natural cycles of climate, that we would have gone from the warming and rising of sea level as the ice sheets melt, and we're about to start the cooling and falling of sea level, that's why it's been stable for the last 6,000 years. That's the foundation to look at now what's happening, that as the ice sheets are melting in Greenland and Antarctica, and with some other effects that I explain, that sea level is starting what will be a 1,000-year rise. It's a new perspective. And that once we see that reality, we should try and slow it by slowing greenhouse gases. But more important, we need to realize that sea level is rising, and we need to begin to adapt to a new coastline.
Is this a cyclical thing that's being accelerated by human behavior, or is this purely cyclical in your mind?
Well, when I started writing the book, I thought it was cyclical and we were accelerating it. It is cyclical, but we've actually changed the cycle, I now realize. And I show it very clearly with a couple of illustrations. There's a simple one that just tracks sea level over the last million years, roughly. And you see that it, again, goes up and down roughly every 100,000 years in concert with the ice ages. Nobody disputes the ice ages. Few people realize that there's a natural cycle to the ice ages and that the last one peaked 20,000 years ago. So the next one would peak about 80,000 years from now. Following that pattern, which has been in existence for 3 million years, so this is a good precedent, long before man's impact, we would be starting to see climate cooling and sea level going down. It's now clearly warming and going up. There's two time perspectives that put that into reality. This is the first dramatic change in 15 million years in terms of the stability of the ice sheets. Now, the last warm period, which was 125,000 years ago, there was a similar blip and sea level got 25 feet higher than today. So there's a more recent precedent. If you think 125,000 is more recent. But sea level, we know, even from that event, that last peak can go much higher than the present, 25 feet, which would be dramatic. But this one's going to go much higher than that because carbon dioxide levels now approaching 400 parts per million, about 40% higher than in the last 15 million years, that correlate with temperatures and ice sheet size and sea level. So we realized that if you follow this 3 million year up and down trend of sea level, that it should be starting to go down. It's now starting to go up. It will go up for at least 1,000 years because of the physics dynamics of the amount of heat stored in the ocean already. So we have changed the direction of that cycle.
In chapter 12 of your book, you really walk the reader through a lot of the cities that are vulnerable around the world to rising sea levels. And of course, you chronicle New Orleans. You presciently hit upon New York City. Why don't you walk us through some of the other regions that real adaptation needs to be made, and sooner than later?
Sure. Rising sea level, for the first time in 6,000 years, our history, means that every coastal city in the world is going to see a new reality in the coming century or two. And just what I cite in chapter 12 there, point out as some examples. And in a good example, you're based there in San Francisco, I believe, Alex, the Sacramento, you know, not too far down the river from where you are, is surprisingly has a greater vulnerability to sea level rise and earthen levees than does New Orleans. Very few people realize it, but there's about 1,100 miles of earthen levees built a century ago. And the state of California has done an evaluation, and it's not practical to re-engineer and rebuild them, particularly in California's current financial situation. But the vulnerability is huge, because not only is it the area of Sacramento, which is valuable in and of itself, but there's the farmland of the, you know, the adjacent valleys where some of the richest agricultural land in the world. So Sacramento is just a great example in your backyard. Of course, the whole San Francisco Bay and Oakland Airport and San Francisco airports also have vulnerability. There are ways of dealing with that, though, for the next century or so that I point out. But spanning or jumping around a little bit, just to give people an idea of how pervasive this is, people don't think of Boston as a low-level city exposed to sea level. And the truth is, it was built on fill land, and it has a tremendous vulnerability. In fact, there's a great plan that was done 30 years ago, how to connect the islands off of Boston Harbor with a network of gates and tunnels that would allow them to keep the sea level within those harbor confines at the present level while the ocean rises higher. That's a wonderful example that's been sitting on the shelf gathering dust since it was created in 1988.
A lot of Boston listeners will immediately think, well, when they spent 10 years and how many billions on the Big Dig, was sea level rise calculated into the engineering that went behind this Big Dig? Did you find any of that in your research?
I'm not sure that I can authoritatively answer the question, but Boston's been pretty good about looking at a 3-foot sea level rise when they re-engineered or rebuilt the wastewater treatment plant at Deer Island about 3 or 4 years ago. During the process, they changed the plans and elevated it by 3 feet to allow for sea level rise. So they have some awareness. I don't know specifically what they did with the Big Dig, but I have to look at that. But what's interesting about the projection of sea level rise that really hardly anybody has yet noticed is this. The best scientific projections are conservative. They're not exaggerated like some people believe. And the conservative projection of 3 feet is now, or a meter, of sea level rise a century, is now being restated as 1 to 2 meters. But even that projection ignores two possibilities, which are not in the calculations or the projections. And that's that there's a big methane release, which has started to happen in the permafrost and from the seabed. And if that accelerates, now that could take 10 years or it could take, frankly, several centuries. We don't know that. We've never warmed this quickly. That would accelerate things because methane can be more than 100 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2, although it does degrade into CO2 over decades. But methane is not really counted in the equation. And the big thing is, what happens in Antarctica? Antarctica, of course, holds most of the fresh water on the planet. It's several miles thick and 7 times bigger than Greenland. And as the Western Antarctic ice sheet, in fact, I identify in the book actually one specific area there's one area of two glaciers that if they loosen up, and they are showing signs of loosening up, we could have a catastrophic sea level rise. Now, not to be alarmist, it's perhaps less than a 50% chance at the moment, but the rates are increasing because it's following a projection made 34 years ago, and it's on schedule. And if that happens, we're going to get about a 6 or 7 foot sea level rise this century. So the point is, not to be alarmist, we need to react to reality that if sea level is going to rise anywhere from 3 foot to 10 foot, whatever the number is, we need to take that as a new reality, and we need to begin adapting to higher sea level.
Deep blue sea, baby, deep blue sea. Deep blue sea, baby, deep blue sea. Deep blue sea, baby, deep blue sea. Yeah, what will it, what got drowned in the deep blue sea, yeah.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and oceanographer John Englander. His book is High Tide on Main Street, Rising Sea Level and the Coming Coastal Crisis. John, you say not to be alarmist. Define alarmist at this point. It seems like that's something that everybody who wants to sound the alarm, so to speak, about rising sea levels feels almost defensive about it. It's like, I don't want to be alarmist, but we really need to start taking some action. Maybe we need to redefine what alarmist means and look at it as more reality than, and when are we all going to wake up to this? And we don't have to keep being quote unquote alarmist.
That's a great question. I think sea level is a special aspect of climate because it is physical and it will destroy real estate. One of our big investments personally in the corporate world and for cities in terms of tax base, et cetera, and just change the shape of the continents. And because that's the first time that's happened in human civilization, it's a very disruptive thing and it's hard to take it calmly, I guess. So the idea that sea level will rise is disruptive. But it's a great vehicle because it nets out why is there more snowfall here and more droughts here and more floods here aspect of climate change, which is confusing. Sea level, again, I use it particularly because it nets it all out. As the world warms, the ice sheets melt and the sea level rises. Real simple. I like to say that ice melts at 32 degrees, whether you're Democrat or Republican or no matter what your political beliefs. It's very easy to see the ice sheets melting. I've taken people to Greenland and to Antarctica and seen not only the ice melting, but talk to people who lived in Greenland for five generations, and what's happening now is unknown within our cultural memory. But when you talk about not being alarmist, I like to say there's an axiom, don't shout fire, you know, in a crowded building. And of course, that makes sense. You don't want people to panic and run. But if somebody was saying there's a fire in the next room and nothing happened and 10 minutes went by and people were still partying, and you said again, hey, everybody, there's a fire in the next room and nothing happened. At some point, common sense would say, shout fire. And I think that sea level and the recent Hurricane Sandy in New York put a real punctuation on this of what can happen. And a lot of people are now looking more carefully. And Sandy was a combination of storm surge on top of the foot of sea level rise this century, on top of lunar high tide, which I explain. But shows the damage of the ocean. The difference with sea level rise than storm surge is it's permanent. When sea level goes up, it's going to be for thousands of years. It won't reverse itself for at least 1,500 years, and I think probably tens of thousands of years. But that's the geologic timescale that we have trouble grappling with. So we shouldn't be alarmists, but we need to use sea level because it gets people's attention because it does affect real estate.
And one of the problems with getting our heads around this concept is that it really takes long-term policy views, and that's not usually what governments or politicians are in the business of doing, is trying to look at a 2 to 4 to 6 year election cycle and how they're going to tell their constituents how they improve their lives over the last few months or last few years. But we're talking decades in this. How do we get our heads around that, and then how do we start moving a little faster than glacially on this really important issue?
That's a great way to put it. And you've really hit the nail on the head, I think, with our political time perspective, particularly today when we're still arguing about how to fix the federal, fiscal cliff, as they talk about. And we keep putting that off, kicking the can down the road. So you're exactly right. I think we do that in two ways. One of the things I encourage in the book is that people to take what they've learned about the history of sea level and of going up and down nearly 400 feet and why it's now rising and why that's different than the past climate cycles of the last 15 million years, and say this is really a change and we are witnessing it. It's just reality. And if they're not too sure whether to act now or to kick the can down the road and not worry about it because it's not their problem, I say, look your grandkids in the eye or think about your grandchildren or the next generation, because this is our legacy. And I find that that really helps people think differently than what's immediately important to them this week. So that's one. And the second thing is that I suggest in the book, actually on the back cover, that within a decade, property values could begin to change. I think that's going to happen a lot more quickly. In fact, I think it's safe to say that you could go and buy some coastal real estate in New Jersey these days for a pretty good bargain. I don't think that that land's going to come back to 100% of its prior value. And I think the vehicle for change that will help those politicians and others is that we have this paradigm shift now where we see sea level differently than our ancestors did, or that we did even 10 years ago. Right now, coastal real estate commands a premium. It's highly desirable. That was all based upon a simple concept that land was permanent, with the odd exception of something that was eroded or destroyed. Well, now we have this fundamental sea change in the way we look at coastal land. It hasn't happened yet, and I thought it'd be a decade. I think Sandy has accelerated that. That the accounting industry, the financial industry, the mortgage industry is going to say, okay, that land is valuable, but it is not as permanent as land in Colorado or 100 miles inland. It needs to be depreciated. That'll be a fundamental shift.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and oceanographer John Englander. He's the author of High Tide on Main Street. John, this one country that I always associate with floods and flooding, anybody who's read the children's story about the boy and the finger in the dike, I forget the name of that story, but the Netherlands is a country that has had several hundred years of dealing with this reality. What can we learn from policymakers in that country that can be applied to the U.S. and other important low-lying areas?
Great question, Alex. Going back to that famous Dutch story of the boy with his finger in the dike, points out Holland's vulnerability, and they are the leaders in the world. And there's two great takeaways from Holland's knowledge and attitude about the ocean. They have built the best technology in the world to deal with storm surge from the North Sea, and they were highly motivated for that from centuries of history. But about 50 years ago, they had a terrible tragedy with a big storm surge that came one night and killed 1,800 people. And they developed the Delta Works, one of the engineering marvels of the world, some huge gates and actually a series of different structures that protect low-lying Holland, which is about one-third below sea level. So they have a unique situation and they have unique technology, and they've shown how rising sea level need not be a death sentence for property or countries. It can be an economic opportunity to build the defenses, to reclaim land, and to allow people to adapt to a new lifestyle. That's the very positive story. On the other hand, they're so realistic about sea level and vulnerability to the ocean. They're paying rapt attention to the issue of sea level rise and the melting ice sheets. And they have done studies which say that if the worst case happens this century, which is certainly possible, as I alluded to earlier, if the ice sheets of Antarctic, particularly Western Antarctic, particularly the couple of glaciers that I name in the book, give way, and if the methane release accelerates the warming and the ice sheet melts in the middle or latter part of the century, we're going to have catastrophic sea level rise. And if that happens, which right now is a low probability, but if that happens, they have calculated that they will have to abandon parts of Holland because at a certain point, there is no practical technology to guard against certain rises in sea level. So they prove both. With the right technology and attitude, we can adapt. We can make it economically viable and have a good future. but we also have to be realistic that if the ice melt continues and accelerates and the worst happens, we need to plan to retreat.
And I'm not really familiar with Dutch politics, but I imagine that they don't have as large a portion of policymakers in their country as we do here in the U.S. who just want to wish away climate change and just put their head in the sand. I'm thinking about the North Carolina lawmakers who reached kind of new heights of denial this last year. Why don't you maybe, if you can compare and contrast the North Carolina law with what's going on in the Netherlands, maybe summarize the North Carolina issues for our listeners who are not familiar with it.
Sure. As you say, the Netherlands culturally has had a reality check because of thousands of people who died and having to live with a country, tiny country below sea level. So for them, it is as real as sunrise or high tide for us. North Carolina is an interesting case in point. You have two schools of thought, some who are holding on to prior concepts and saying we haven't yet proven that that the ocean's rising. And then some are saying, well, we can't prove that it's man is causing it. Now some are saying, well, maybe it's rising and maybe man's causing it indirectly by greenhouse gases, but maybe we can't do anything about it. But it came to a head, as you pointed out, in I believe it was June or May last of 2012, when they tried to pass a law. Actually, they did pass a law, but they changed it, which said that for the next 3 years, I believe, that any state agency or state-funded study or project could only project future sea level rise based upon what has happened for the last 100 years. So there can be no acceleration of sea level rise, basically. And it was so ridiculous that besides being ridiculed on the Colbert Report and kind of nationwide as how does the legislature tell scientists or engineers what is real, but they did back off a little bit and they said, okay, for a period of the next 3 years, we're just going to base our projections on the historic, that some people think it may be a time to allow them to adjust to the reality that sea level is rising and they need to get with reality and stop being the laughingstock of the nation or the world by trying to legislate scientific facts. I think things are changing. But again, like in all other changing perceptions of the world, from Galileo's The Sun Being the Center of the Universe, things take time to change. But fortunately, I'm pleased to see that the majority of the public actually gets it. For some reason, it's Congress and I guess the North Carolina legislature too, that perhaps out of self-interest or special interest is in denial. But I don't think that's going to hold up too long.
His new book is High Tide on Main Street. John Englander, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I enjoyed it.
Said I'd lead you the lowlands where the sad-eyed prophet say that no man comes. Now should I lead them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Hedman. He is the CEO of Thermapure. Thermapure is a mold remediation company as well as having several other related technologies to overcoming some of the issues that people who are suffering from rising sea levels and major storms like we just witnessed in Sandy in New York will become more and more familiar with as we move forward. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Delighted to be with you.
My description there was probably a little haphazard, but why don't you tell us the definitive definition of what Thermapure is?
You bet. Thermapure is essentially structural pasteurization. We pasteurize our food to make it safe to consume. Similarly, Thermapure patented the idea of pasteurizing structures. So if we have a structure which has been inundated with water intrusion, ThermoPure dries the structure faster. If there is fungi or bacteria or other floodborne pathogens which have developed in the structure, the real beauty of ThermoPure is we kill it with heat rather than filling your home or commercial structure with chemicals.
So you're based in Southern California, but can it be used in places where your company is not based?
Yes. In fact, we've licensed the technology now covering most of North America.
So walk us through a little bit more of the nuts and bolts of the technology, if you can.
You bet. Let's focus primarily on water intrusion. Typically, if a structure is flooded, of course, you're going to remove the water, but we have a damp structure. That damp structure is very vulnerable to microorganisms and the development of pathogens, which could be harmful to people. And the real beauty of this technology is that heat, much like pasteurization, is ovicidal. So if we have bacteria, which begins growing almost immediately when the floodwaters develop, if we have fungi, which begins developing in about 48 to 72 hours, mold growth in structures in interstitial wall cavities or in and around the structure itself, the beauty of this technology is it's much more cost effective, yet it's green because we're able to heat up that structure, dry it more quickly than the status quo, which is using dehumidification technology primarily. ThermoPure, on the other hand, is going to take about half to a third of the time to dry the structure, and at the same time, we're going to be killing those microorganisms.
Does ThermoPure, is it purely in homes, or can you also be an industrial solution as well?
Absolutely industrial. In fact, one of the advantages of the technology is that it's very scalable. We could do a doghouse, or we can do a high-rise building.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking with the CEO of ThermoPure, David Hedman. David, what kind of temperatures are we talking about with this heat?
Well, it's typically pasteurization-type temperatures that we'd see for food. So 130, 140 degrees is typical. However, if we have a target organism that is much more difficult, we can raise the temperature. For example, we were brought in to inactivate the weaponized anthrax that we were hit with years ago when that was brought into some of the buildings such as USA Today, the Gannett building. We can bring the temperature down if we're targeting bed bugs, which is a relatively easy target for us. We may be around 120 degrees. These are sauna type temperatures, temperatures you would see typically if you were to go to a club and be in a dry sauna.
So if Hurricane Sandy had occurred in December, January in New York City rather than October when it was warmer, do you think the mold issues and bacteria spread would have been mitigated by those colder temperatures, or is that negligible?
I think this is an excellent question, Alex, because we often see the microorganisms go dormant, and we'll see moisture trapped in a structure when it turns cold, and then as spring comes, for example, in the New York, New Jersey area, you'll see thawing, but the moisture is actually in interstitial locations such as wall cavities. So it's really the second storm that develops in the spring in a cold environment. And that's really what we're concerned about with Sandy. So we anticipate that this spring there will be many people in the affected area who will then just begin to notice the proliferation of mold in their structures.
People can go learn more about ThermoPure at ThermoPure.com. He's David Hedman. He's the founder and CEO of ThermoPure. Thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio, David.
Alex, delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to SeaChange Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Tommy Flanagan, Alvin Youngblood Hart, and Bob Dylan.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.